I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Welcome to the Sunday Magazine podcast, featuring the stories we first brought you Sunday, May 5th, on CBC Radio. Foreign interference, campus protests, and a wacko week in the House of Commons. Our Sunday politics panel is here first up to tackle it all. After that, he wore a tricorn hat, carried a musket, and traded social media for a quill pen and parchment. A.J. Jacobs will tell us what his experiment living by an originalist reading of the U.S. Constitution taught him about modern America. Also today, a player in present-day politics south of our border, former White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, will riff on the line between Politico and pundit and what comms advice she'd give her old boss, Joe Biden, in this U.S. election year. And later on, it's time for all of us to put our brains to the test as we play another round of our monthly challenge, That's Puzzling. It all starts right now on the Sunday Magazine. Tensions were high across our country this past week, both in the political and public arenas. Pro-Palestinian protests on American campuses have now made their way to some Canadian universities. On the political front, the long-awaited interim report into foreign interference into federal elections was released, and that came on the same day that arrests were made in the murder that has made for very tense relations between Canada and India. And if you haven't heard by now, there was debate and disgruntlement around the use of the word wacko. So with all of that, we have convened our Sunday Magazine political panel. Susan Delacourt is a national columnist with the Toronto Star, and Matt Gurney is a SiriusXM host and co-founder of The Line on Substack. Hi, both of you.
Good morning. Good morning.
I will reserve my use of the word wacko for the context in which we will discuss it a little bit later. But there has been a lot going on this past week with lots of political ramifications. So I want to begin on the international front, particularly about relations between Canada and India. So, Susan, the RCMP on Friday announced that it's arrested three men, none of them citizens of our country, in connection with the killing of Canadian Sikh activist Hardeep Singh Nijjar in Surrey, BC, last June. Now, this murder has caused great tensions between India and Canada for months, as Prime Minister Trudeau alleges this killing was ordered at the highest levels of the Indian government. What does this now mean, Susan, for Canada's relationship with India with these arrests?
You know, I've been trying to figure that out, which means I'm going to give an unsatisfactory answer to this. Everything I know about this, I have learned from the incredible reporting of the CBC's Evan Dyer, who seems to know more than all of us about what has happened here. This has been a surprising case in every aspect. From the Prime Minister doing an extraordinary statement last September to the diplomatic spat that it has cost. And I don't know that this is going to resolve it. I was watching a couple of people, actually, security experts, saying on television on Friday that India is never going to admit its connection to this. So will this fix it? Again, my unsatisfactory answer is I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, yesterday India's foreign minister said this is an internal matter for Canada, but then went on to say, you know, Canada lets in some unsavory characters. But that seems to be India's point at this
point, Matt. These three men are now going to start their legal proceedings. The investigation by the RCMP and other law enforcement agencies will continue. So other people might be charged. But, you know, in that reporting, and I think Evan Dyer had this in his reporting, this group of alleged assassins may have been involved in other killings in our country, including the shooting of an 11-year-old boy in Edmonton. Now, if this is true, if this is proven, that would raise this to a whole new level of a hit squad on Canadian soil. So, like, when we talk about foreign interference, this is of the kind of a very sinister way. What's at stake, do you think, here for Canada?
I think we need to get the actual criminal proceedings right here. And one of the things that I think, and this covers the Najjar killing, the shooting of that young boy in Edmonton, but also what we're going to talk about in a minute with the foreign interference inquiry. One of the consistent themes here is that security experts and those on the inside are saying that Canada's viewed as an easy mark, that there's no consequences for taking us on, that we have ineffective ways of dealing with this. So we had the Najjar killing, and then we had, as Pia, you've already said, that explosive revelation when the Prime Minister announced that we believe that that was linked directly to the Indian government here. And then kind of months go by with not much happening, except for the diplomatic spat here. We need to demonstrate to the world, including our enemies and our rivals, that there are consequences for this. And I'm not saying we need to retaliate in their own country or something. But if you send a hit squad into our country, there needs to be a reasonably good chance that we're going to detect it, stop it from doing its job. And if we can't do that, then we're going to arrest and charge the people and then sentence them. If you are a foreign government meddling in our elections, there needs to be a reasonable probability that we're going to detect it, disrupt it, and then name and shame you here. So I'm glad these charges were laid here, but I do worry about that long gap between not only the killing, but then later the revelation by the Prime Minister. That does probably, I have to assume, breed a sense of impunity on those who may wish us harm.
Okay, let's talk about the foreign interference report. This is an initial report. This commission was established last September, led by Justice Marie-Josée Hogue. Like the Johnston report, which came before it, and we'll talk about that in a bit. This one found foreign meddling did not determine the past two federal elections, but it did flag what it called, quote, troubling events. Susan, speaking of talking about things for a long time, we've been talking about this kind of foreign interference for several months now. Did anything in this initial report shock or surprise you?
No, not really. In fact, it more or less confirmed what was in the Johnston report, with a bit of a harsher tone. And I can't say I was surprised by it, or anything really stood out to me except the idea that it had happened. I keep viewing this through the prism of why I wanted a foreign interference inquiry. Yeah. And I want Canadians to be reassured that our democracy is safe. And one of the reasons I want that is because I think we're watching what happens in the United States when people start questioning the legitimacy of elections. So that was my major prism in which I was watching this. And I thought it was interesting to watch everybody struggling with saying, how do you call out foreign interference without making people lose their faith in the system? You know, she called it a stain. It's a stain on our electoral processes or electoral system. That's not good. And we don't want Canadians thinking that when they go to vote next time. So that's what I'm going to be watching for in the next days, is how this is landing, not with the political parties, but how the political parties are conveying its results to Canadians.
Okay, I'm going to come back to that point with you, Susan, in just a sec, but I want to get Matt in, sort of like in your initial reading of this, Matt, on Friday, was there any moment where you're like, whoa, that's huge?
No, I'm with Susan. It basically fit my understanding of what the report was likely to be, but it also fit, I think, my understanding as informed by the Johnston report, but then everything we'd learned at the Hogue Commission since. I had been following it pretty closely, so I wasn't really expecting any curveballs. I think Susan's right, and Pia, you've said we'll talk about the political ramifications in a minute. But I think in the meantime, I agree with Susan's characterization that this is largely what Johnston had to say, but saying it with like more exclamation points and more pointed fingers, saying, see, there are real problems here. And I do think in particular, this is something that I've I don't want to say I feel vindicated about this. Like, if anything, I find it depressing. But I have everything I have written about this since the Johnston report has been, we are getting one signal after another that we are not handling intelligence correctly in this country, that we have serious issues with the collection of it, the dissemination of it, and also making sure that senior leaders are actually in a position where they can use it. And if you can't use the intelligence you have, you might as well not have it. And this is something that I have written about probably three or four times in just the last year, saying, why do we keep getting... The term I used in my latest column is, why do we as a country keep getting punched in the face by reality? Like, we find out in hindsight, we're like, oh, yes, we did have intelligence about this, but we didn't do anything with it. We weren't able to make use of it. To see the commissioner in her report explicitly make that point was, to me, again, a little, I felt a little bit like vindication, but it also felt sad. Like, I really wanted to be wrong on that. I wanted to read this report and be reassured that, no, in fact, we're doing a better job than it appears from the outside. But no, it turns out from the inside, they're doing just as bad a job at this as it appeared to me on the outside.
Okay, so given what you just said, Matt, then what does a Liberal government need to do now, to Susan's point, to shore up Canadians' faith in our democracy, given what the Johnston report and now the Ogle report, the initial report, have said? Matt, you go first, and then I'll go to you, Susan.
Okay.
Yeah, I do think that, like, what we're talking about here is not, I'm going to channel the Trailer Park Boys here. It's not rocket appliances, right? Like, this is not particularly complicated stuff. Intelligence doesn't get from the people who have it to the people who need it. When it does get there, which is not all the time, the people who are receiving it aren't briefed in the context necessary for them to do something with it. Even if they are briefed in the context of what to do with it, and even if they are seized with the sense that they ought to do something about it, they don't always know what to do, and they may have their own reasons for choosing not to do so. As noted, as the Prime Minister said at one point, like with the Don Valley West nomination, if we had done anything with this, he says, it could have damaged our ability to win that seat. So we've put ourselves in a position where the system is dysfunctional, and even if it does work, it might not actually be acted on. You ask me, what do we do about that? And my honest sense is, it's probably easier to figure out the communication issues. Like, it's probably possible to figure out some kind of process or protocol, or maybe honestly have fewer processes and protocols, try to streamline this to make sure that CSIS has the ability to, not even the ability, the obligation to proactively inform and brief a larger cross-section of Canadian government, of Canadian society, where they are responsible for providing that briefing, for providing all the context information around it to understand it correctly. So those are the things we can do. But fundamentally, if the executive leadership of either the country or of specific political parties chooses not to do anything with that information, that's not a problem we can solve with legislation.
Susan, you said, look, I want my democracy to be safe, and I don't know yet how Canadians are feeling about this, but what would be your sort of suggestions on how the government at this point goes about doing that?
Well, there's good questions to be raised about whether anybody's listening to anything this government says at the moment, but maybe that's another topic altogether. We did see Public Safety Minister Dominic LeBlanc doing a round of interviews on Friday after the report was tabled, and saying we're going to see legislation this week. He has not said whether that's going to be a foreign agent registry. I've always wondered about this. You know, I know we probably do need it, but I think if you're planning to do things like send a hit squad to Canada, do you register for that? Like, more seriously, I think we are going to see the government table legislation that is going to plug some of the holes by which foreign and bad actors get into the system. Will that reassure Canadians? I don't know. Again, I'm saying that a lot this morning.
That's okay. It's okay. Lots to be determined. Let me ask you before we move on, both of you, and quickly, if you would. David Johnston, who was a special rapporteur appointed by the Prime Minister looking into Chinese government interference in Canadian elections, was vilified by the opposition for coming out against a public inquiry when he made his report, and then he resigned. So with this initial OG report coming out, yes, there's more to come in terms of recommendations and a final report. Did we need this public inquiry? Just briefly, Susan, did we need this thing?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. It mainly because Mr. Johnson was vilified, but I do think as much transparency as possible.
Matt?
I agree entirely. We did, the broad shape of this is not any different than what David Johnson had said, but some of the details, and I also think some of the fire lighting under certain bottoms in the federal government that might motivate action here, that was necessary, and it was only going to come with a public inquiry. So I have to disagree with the imminent Canadian, David Johnson. We needed this, and I honestly don't know. And I mean, to his point, right, he always said it wouldn't be possible to do one because of all the classification issues. We seem to have done just fine.
Hmm. Okay, yeah. There's more to come as Justice Oge continues her investigation into all this. I want to switch gears. It was I'll call it a weird week instead of a wacko week last week in the House of Commons. Midweek, things got really nasty.
When will we put an end to this wacko policy by this wacko prime minister?
No. I'm going to ask the Honourable Leader of the Opposition one last time to please withdraw that comment and simply withdraw that comment.
Okay, this goes on. After Pierre Poilievre called Prime Minister Trudeau a wacko, you heard House Speaker Greg Fergus there. He boots Poilievre from the House of Commons. Poilievre kind of has this back and forth about refusing to withdraw or changing words. But in the end, he refuses to withdraw the statement. He's kicked out. That leads to the Conservatives calling for the Speaker to resign, which he says he's not doing. Matt, what is going on here? Like, does this go beyond name calling and decorum and just like my, tired sounding, what is happening here?
Okay, I actually have a specific theory about this, and I'm excited to talk about this morning. I got up this morning. I'm like, yes, finally we can talk about this. But okay, let's state the obvious here. The Prime Minister and Pierre Poilievre, they don't like each other. And there's obviously a lot of bad blood between these two guys. I also think I'm not going beyond the scope of the recognized to say that we live in a very polarized political time in Canada. There's a lot of division. There's a lot of anger out there. So the three of us always would have known that there was a political silly season in this country, and probably by December and probably again by June, that everybody's at each other's throats. Everybody needs to shut up and go home and do some laundry and sleep in their own beds. I have a theory that silly season, because of all the dislike out there, now starts in November and now starts in May. I don't know how we're going to get through another 18 months of this with all basically scratching our own eyeballs out, but this is what we are living with here. I know that Pierre Poilievre took the brunt of the fire this week, but what was forgotten was that the Prime Minister's exchange with him, it didn't veer into unparliamentary language, but it was not exactly a verbal pat on the back. Like, these two guys are going at each other in the House. I think Pierre Poilievre made a mistake. I don't think he should have done what he did here, but we should put it in that context. If these two guys are sick of each other, they're tired, they don't like each other, and it's turning nasty. And I think it's going to stay nasty.
Okay. We, as Canadians, though, have these two guys and others, I should mention, that we have to, watch and listen to and hold accountable at this point. Susan, you have seen a lot in your time in Ottawa in your many years. Where does this one sit for you?
This is the worst I've seen. I know that, people are going to say that there's always been nonsense in the House of Commons, and that's true. But this is so visceral and personal, like Matt is saying. It goes to the core of their being. They do not like each other, not because of policy reasons, because of the people they are. Mm-hmm. So that is, to distinguish between bad behavior and bad people. These guys are calling each other bad people. And that's not going to stop. And it's going to get worse, and it's going to be hard for us to watch. But yes, I found it really difficult to watch on Tuesday, on both sides. And I don't think we're being particularly well served by this, but it gives some sense of what both men believe the stakes are in the next election too.
Okay, the division seemed to continue. And as Matt said, look, we're seeing it in all kinds of places. So let us talk about these pro-Palestinian protests that are going on at several Canadian campuses. Matt, you went to an encampment. You wrote that the university should get rid of them as soon as possible, and you can talk about that. But I also want to talk about you drawing these comparisons, because I think this speaks to the divided nature of our country, to what we're seeing on campuses, to the trucker convoy protests 2 years ago. What's the connection, and how should people be thinking of their own views of one and then the other?
Yeah, I first made this point a couple of weeks ago, and I was, you know, obviously people disagreed, and some of that disagreement I thought was fair. People were saying that, well, the context of the protest is different, and of course it is, and also the nature of the protest is different, and of course it was, but now that there are encampments, I think it's a little more similar than it might have been. But fundamentally, you know, I think we as a country need to have a decision about whether or not extreme rhetoric and symbols within a protest movement speak to that protest movement or don't. And it, I guess it's just kind of a statement of the banal on human nature that we are quick to forgive our own and quick to condemn our opponents. But I just want someone to tell me, like, are encampments for protest purposes okay? Does extremist hateful rhetoric within a protest movement discredit that movement or not? I've been looking ever since these protests started for some kind of a consistent standard. And I know full well that there are people in this country, and I'm not telling them they shouldn't have been, who were very, very alarmed by the protest of hate, the presence of hate symbols at the convoy, but will bend over backwards to explain the nuances to me of the phrase I saw scrawled on the ground at the U of T encampment, which was telling Jews to go back to Europe. So I'm just asking here, I promise I will be equally freaked out by whatever we decide the societal standard ought to be, but we need to decide what that standard is, and we need to decide it on a basis other than I like these people more, therefore I'm prepared to forgive them.
Yeah, what Matt just said, Susan, like, really causes a lot of challenges for politicians, too, of all stripes, right? And of all jurisdictions. We saw the justice minister, federal justice minister, Arif Rani, who's had people protesting in front of his house and has not been happy about that, but making the point that universities in Canada are provincial jurisdiction. I'm wondering about the politics of this, because I don't think it matters if you work at the municipal, the provincial, or federal level. You're trying to figure out what to do here and what to say. But in terms of the federal government, does the fact that universities' provincial jurisdiction sort of let them off the hook on this one at this point?
No, not at all. I really hate when any level of government tries to throw to the other one, too. We're all the same people. We're represented by different people, but we are the same citizens. So, no, it doesn't let them off the hook. And they find all kinds of ways to weigh into provincial jurisdiction when they want to. So, nobody's off the hook here. I think I share with Matt the same concerns. I also hark back to something Matt wrote during the convoy that still haunts me, is the outside actors who come in and hijack these protests or infiltrate them, whatever. Maybe it is foreign interference, but I watched the mayor of New York talking about the fact that a lot of people being arrested at their protests really had nothing to do with the universities. They were, you know, infiltrating, I guess. So that was the worry during the convoy, and it's, I guess, the worry during these protests as well, too. Again, I worry, though, that this debate is a far more divisive one than the one for the convoy. You know, most Canadians got vaccinated during the pandemic. The convoy was basically about sort of an anti-vax movement gone wild. So it was easy to oppose that if you were the federal government, because most Canadians were on the side of pandemic protocols. This one, every politician in Ottawa knows it is dividing people. What is going on in the Middle East is dividing people in their hearts and souls, in their families, at the community level. And it's very hard to weigh in on this one. So I think you're going to see politicians of all kinds trying to throw to somebody else. But ultimately, they're afraid of this one because it's dividing people so deeply.
Matt, you got about 30 seconds. You know, we've been talking about how, how democracy is being challenged, our democracy at many levels. So I'll just sort of give you the last word on that point.
Yeah, I can sum up democracy, foreign interference in the Middle East in 30 seconds. I'm totally up to that. What I'm looking for here, and it applies whether it's these protests or the convoy or foreign interference, I'm looking for that consistent standard. I want us to think as citizens. I want us to think as people who are going to have to live in this country with each other whenever the next crisis du jour has happened to pass here. I think the most corrosive thing happening out there is that the only standard any of us are prepared to enforce is the one that makes our opponents look bad, and we are prepared to overlook a whole lot of stuff that makes our own look bad here. If we don't fix this problem, guys, if we don't fix the problems with intelligence sharing and having consistent standards, we're not going to need China to interfere with us. We're going to tear ourselves apart. So that's a grim ending in my 30 seconds, but there you go.
Well, you hit the 30 seconds, so congratulations on that point. And thank you both, as always. Really smart conversation this morning. Appreciate both of you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Susan Delacourt is a national columnist with the Toronto Star. Matt Gurney is a SiriusXM host and co-founder of The Line on Substack. You're listening to the Sunday Magazine on CBC Radio, SiriusXM 169, as well as on the CBC Listen app. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. We're going to keep on the political train of sorts. There is a curious contradiction about our neighbors to the south. The USA, the land of futuristic technology and cutting-edge culture, can also sometimes seem to be living in the past, centuries in the past, in fact. At least that's one way to look at court rulings and laws that seem to many to put things like women's rights and gun laws out of step with many other Western democracies. Much of that has to do with something called originalism. That is the idea that Americans should live by its constitution as written by its founders back in 1787 and live by its ensuing amendments as well. Depending on how you see things, this idea could strike you as a little bit absurd. To H.A. Jacobs, though, the best-selling author of books like The Year of Living Biblically, it sounded like a challenge. His latest book is called The Year of Living Constitutionally, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Constitution's Original Meaning. A.J. Jacobs, good morning.
Good morrow. I had to do that. I'm sorry.
Well, let us continue down this path. I am looking at the cover of your book here. It's New York City in the background, which is where you live. It's you holding a big piece of paper, and you're wearing a hat. Nice hat.
Yes, a tricorn hat, to be specific. Yeah, when I do my project, as you know, Pia, I commit to the bit. So when I wrote about the Bible, I felt it was important to dress the part. So I wore a robe and sandals. And when I decided to live by the original meaning of the U.S. Constitution, I put on my tricorn hat and my breeches and my buckled shoes, and I bore my musket around New York.
Like for how long? Like for a full year? You walked around with this, I don't want to offend anyone, but I'm going to call it ridiculous hat, and carried a musket like everywhere you went?
Well, I didn't carry the musket everywhere. That was only on special occasions. But yes, I tried to wear the tricorn hat. I mean, it is, I agree, it is weird and silly, but there is some evidence that the way you dress, your outer affects the inner. So I thought, if I'm going to go all in, I better go all in.
Mm-hmm. The outer also affects a lot of judgment. A lot of characters in New York. I'm wondering, like, when you're walking down the street, what kind of glances did you get?
Well, this was especially true when I carried my musket, which is because that my Second Amendment right is to bear arms. And so I had people in New York crossing the street to avoid me. That's true. But it did come in handy at least one time, because I arrived at a coffee shop at the same time as another customer, and he said, "Oh, you go first. I'm not arguing with a guy holding that." So it did have its uses.
Mm-hmm. We're going to put your gun down just for a bit. We'll talk more about the musket a bit later. But I said in the introduction, like, your whole experiment really has to do with constitutional originalism. This is, you know, in its extreme form. But how do you explain what originalism really means?
Well, originalism is one of two broad ways of interpreting the U.S. Constitution. And it's mostly a conservative movement, not completely. But the idea is that the most important thing in interpreting the Constitution is what the words meant in 1791 when it was ratified. And this is opposed to living constitutionalism, which is much more about that the words evolve, the meaning of the words evolve. And it's very similar, part of the reason I did it, it's very similar to the debates we have over the Bible. The fundamentalist idea that we have to get back to that original meaning versus the idea, no, the meaning evolves as morals evolve.
You offer up a good metaphor for understanding originalism. To look at the Constitution not like, say, a poem or a metaphor that's open to interpretation, but like a recipe.
Yes. And I didn't make this up. This is a traditional originalist argument. It says the Constitution is a recipe. It's like a chicken salad recipe. That's what they use. And you don't change the ingredients. You don't change the times of baking if you want to have an edible chicken salad sandwich. And the same with the Constitution. It is a binding contract. And it is what is keeping us having a functioning democracy. It's law and order. You can't just willy-nilly. Originalism began in a large part as a reaction to the liberal Supreme Court, which passed all of these landmark civil rights decisions, like Brown versus Board of Education, which made school segregation illegal. And they thought, the conservatives were upset. They said, these liberals are just legislating from the bench. They are just willy-nilly making up rules that are not in the Constitution and that we didn't vote on. So we are going to clamp down and say only what's in the Constitution is constitutional.
When you're talking about school segregation, I'm actually jumping forward to 2023-24, AJ, because I'm thinking about the Dobbs decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, which overturned Roe v. Wade, because you're talking about liberal judges and too much liberalism, and the people who back originalism say, no, we got to stick to the Constitution. So is that what you also think of? Is this an example, the overturning of Roe v. Wade?
Absolutely. That is an originalist decision. The original Roe v. Wade decision was because there are implied rights, unwritten rights in the Constitution. So the Constitution never says we guarantee the right to free choice for women, but it does have sections on privacy. It has sections on equal protection. So that's where the liberal judges said, okay, so this, if we look at it broadly, applies to women's right to choose. Conservatives are much narrower in their interpretation. They say, well, there is nothing about women's right to choose in the Constitution. And in fact, there's not really a right to privacy in the Constitution. There are hints of it, but we have got to stick with what's in the Constitution, and the rest is for the states to decide. That is not our job, to say that there should be a national constitutional right for women to choose.
And these are the debates we see playing out all over in many, many states currently. As for your experiment, AJ, it wasn't just a hat and a musket. You lived really by the letter of the Constitution. So you exercised all the rights that it gives you, including freedom of speech that's defined in the First Amendment. What did that look like in practice for you over this past year?
Well, it was fascinating. I mean, first of all, I was looking at what really was the original meaning, which was actually very different from what the originalists on the Supreme Court say it is. And secondly, should we abide by the original meaning? How much should we give that? So that in reality looked like I carried a musket, as I said. I gave up social media and wrote pamphlets with a quill pen by candlelight, because that is the way the First Amendment was expressed. The Founding Fathers they wouldn't have known what to do with Twitter. I applied for a letter of marque and reprisal, which is a weird, obscure part of the Constitution that allows American citizens to become pirates, legalized pirates, and go and fight enemies in the open seas. No one had been granted one since 1815, but I thought, well, I'm doing it. Let's apply. I haven't received a go ahead yet.
And so what, as you're going through this experiment, what are you learning, right? Because there was a goal behind this experiment, right? Like you were trying to kind of see how this plays in the modern world. But what were you kind of taking in as you're having conversations, handing out pamphlets and stuff?
Right. Well, there are several takeaways. One is that I do think that originalism is not the best way to interpret our Constitution. I much prefer a more pluralistic way where you take into account what was the original meaning, but also what consequences would a decision have now? What would our descendants think? What has the Supreme Court ruled in the last 25 years? All of these things, I think, are more, it's more American, it's more balanced. So that is one big. Another takeaway was that the 18th century had, we don't want to go back to the 18th century. It was, in many ways, horrible. It was not the good old days. It was racist, sexist, homophobic, smelly, dangerous. So that is not what I want to do. However, I like to be nuanced, so I was also exploring, are there ideas from the 18th century that are worth reviving? And I found there were several ideas, and one of my favorites is election cakes. Back in the 1700s, for those who were privileged enough to be allowed to vote, it was a celebration. It was the first time anyone had voted on their own leaders. So people... It wasn't quite Coachella, but people would they would drink rum punch. They would have music and farmers markets and election cake. People would bake election cakes, hundreds of them, bring them to the polls, bring them to work. And I just love this idea that we need to celebrate democracy. Democracy is sweet. So I was able to start a movement where hundreds of people baked election cakes for the last election. So that's just one small example of something that is worth looking at again.
Okay, I want to talk about some other things you experimented with. The 14th Amendment, which is known as equal protection, it was added after the Civil War. It gave voting rights to African American men. But according to the originalist, it may not offer, you know, quote unquote, equal protection to women. How so, and how did you experiment with the 14th Amendment?
Yes, if you are a hardcore originalist, then you have to look at the original meaning of when this was passed, which was right after the Civil War, and it was specifically meant to address black men and their rights. They were not thinking of women, and they were not thinking of gay people. So if you are a hardcore originalist, and Clarence Thomas has indicated that this is his interpretation, the 14th Amendment, which is equal protection for all, does not apply to women. It doesn't apply to gay people. So rulings like the Obergefell, which guaranteed the right to gay marriage, under hardcore originalism would probably be overturned. And I said, well, this is interesting. If I'm going to see what would this truly originalist world look like, and it is very scary, because in the 1800s, there were tons of sexist laws that would be considered constitutional under this hardcore originalist reading. For instance, women were treated like children, especially married women had fewer rights than single women. So my wife, for instance, would not be allowed to write or sign contracts. Now, she owns a business, an event business, and signs several contracts a day. And so I said, well, since I'm doing this experiment, maybe I should take over.
You did not.
I did. It did not go. Well, you know what? At first, she was like, great, I hate doing these contracts. And then it soon became clear how incompetent I am, because she is much more financially savvy than me. So I made a mess of it, and I was fired after 1 hour, and she returned to her seat. But that is an example of what might happen if we really go and take this originalism to its logical extreme. But,
yeah. Okay, I said we'd talk about the gun, so let's talk about this. You were carrying a musket. A musket, for people who can't imagine one, it is cumbersome, is that fair?
Yes.
To handle. It's a big gun. This
right.
is not something you can pack easily. There are originalists who say the Constitution, you know, written all those centuries ago, permits them to carry around a semi-automatic weapon, something like an AR-15 today, right? And this is right. the musket to the semi-automatic trajectory that we're seeing. What's the logic?
Well, just to back up and describe the musket a little more, it is heavy, as you said, it's 10 pounds. And I went on ye old internet and bought an actual one from the 1700s.
What?
And it is hard to shoot. It takes at least 15 steps to shoot. You got to take out the ramrod. You got to pour the gunpowder in. So it is a very different experience. It's like building an IKEA table as opposed to just pulling a trigger. So it is a very different. Now, the two sides on the gun control side, they would say that look at the difference between a musket and an AR-15. They are two completely different objects. It's just a coincidence they both fall under the word arms. But it's like having a law that says wheeled vehicles are allowed on next to this house. And at the time, wheeled vehicles were carts or bicycles. Now we have Mack trucks. So should we change the law? Probably, because that's a very different experience. So same with muskets and AR-15s, that when the technology so outstrips the original meaning, you have to adjust the law. Now, the other side, the gun rights side, would say, that's like saying the First Amendment, free speech, should only apply to printing presses made in the 18th century. You have to make it broader. So it is interesting. I tend to think that they are such different machines that they do need different laws.
I imagine that in every one of these sort of experiments within experiments, you know, there's a lot of controversy almost on all of them, but that you're sort of being conflicted as you go through them, I imagine. But I would say, AJ, like, I think probably, and tell me if I'm wrong, the most sensitive area of all that you may have had to confront in following the original Constitution is the issue of race. You live in New York City, a city that's very diverse, but also a country that is very diverse, and race and racism, very, very important issues for your country and mine to be discussing and dealing with. The original Constitution protected slavery. There were provisions for returning escaped slaves. It talked about, you know, enslaved men as counting as 3/5 of a person in terms of a state's congressional representation. And so in your journey, you asked the question, what are we supposed to do with a document like this written by enslavers? Burn it or find a way to work with it?
Yes. I was, by the way, following the whole Constitution, including the amendments. So there is the 13th Amendment that made slavery illegal. But it is still, like you said, the problem. This document was written by many of the signers had enslaved people. And one of my great inspirations in this area is Frederick Douglass, who was an orator and abolitionist in the 19th century around the Civil War. And there were, like you say, two ways to approach the Constitution. One is to burn it, to say it's a pact with the devil. And that is exactly what William Lloyd Garrison, who is the other huge abolitionist and a white man, that was what he took. He literally burned the Constitution in front of a crowd of people. Originally, Frederick Douglass, who's a former enslaved man, he agreed with Garrison. But somewhere in the 1850s, he changed tactics, or he changed his mind. And he said, like you said, let us work within it to change it. And he adopted the idea that the Constitution is a promissory note. It contains language about equality and liberty, and yet America was obviously not living up to these words. So he said, let's not burn the Constitution. Let's make America live up to the promises within the Constitution. And that is the tactic that Martin Luther King, he used the phrase promissory note. Obama gave a famous speech on race where he said the same thing, that the Constitution itself contains the seeds of liberation that we need to grow and allow America to live up to its promises.
So what do you think the founding fathers would think about this case that is currently in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, brought about by former President Donald Trump, essentially in a nutshell, asking whether a president would or should have immunity for anything done while they're on the job? What do you think the founding fathers would make of that?
Well, I can't say that I can totally get into the founding fathers' mindset, but my guess is they would be appalled that they specifically set up a government where everyone was under the rule of law because they were rebelling against a monarchy, no offense to Canada or the UK, where one person was considered above the law. So I believe that they would... They would be appalled at the hubris of someone saying that laws don't apply to him just because he happened to be president.
Hmm. It's an interesting time for your country, for Americans. You hear a lot of pessimism and worry, fear about the preservation of democracy. Your country and around the world, frankly, there's a lot of fear about that. But AJ, how did this deep dive into the Constitution leave you feeling about the future, not only of your country, but of democracy?
You know what? I actually feel more optimistic. With an asterisk. Asterisk is that we have a lot of work to do. But first of all, it was clear that in the founders' time, they had even more obstacles to founding a democracy, and they figured it out. And also, just reading about all of the ideas over history of how to improve democracy, the fact that we have improved it still needs a long way to go, but we have given women the vote, we have given Black and Indigenous people the vote, and there are so many practical reforms that we can do, whether it's something like an 18-year term limit on the Supreme Court, getting rid of gerrymandering. There are all of these things we can do to make it more democratic, and that's what we have to dig in and do. And if we do that, I do think that democracy can survive and thrive.
Okay, so we're still a number of months till Election Day in November. Are you going to make election cakes? What are you going to do?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I want, we had hundreds last time. I want thousands. And
people, kind of cakes? How do you make an election cake? What is this thing?
Well, the original 1780s recipe has cloves and figs. So it's not to everyone's taste right now.
Sounds like a Christmas cake or a fruit cake.
It is very, yes, exactly. But I am not a dictator, so I say whatever your interpretation of election cake is, I encourage it. And people went and would write vote on the cakes, or they themed it to their state. So Georgia grows a lot of peaches, so they had peach cakes in Georgia. And I know you're in Canada, but listen, we could use all the support we can get. So if you want to bake some cakes in support of us, we would love it.
Yeah, maple syrup or Nanaimo bars or Canadian things. Listen, I said before we started, you're one of the strangest people I've talked to over the years. I love hearing about all your experiments. I can't wait to see what you do next. But for now, take off the tricorn hat, hang up the musket somewhere securely, and enjoy this election year.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And huzzah. I should just end with huzzah for democracy.
Huzzah. Thanks, AJ.
Thank you.
AJ Jacobs' new book is called The Year of Living Constitutionally.
The climate is changing, so are we. I'm Laura Lynch, and I host What on Earth? That's CBC's Climate Solutions podcast. Twice a week, we take you around the world to find the people who are trying to build a better future for all of us. We explore indigenous science, new technologies. We talk openly about mental health and climate anxiety. We also take your smart questions all the time. Come find What on Earth wherever you get your podcasts.
When Jen Psaki stood at the White House lectern on January 20th, 2021, it signaled a new era in Washington, D.C. After the Trump administration's infrequent briefings and tumultuous relationship with the media, U.S. President Joe Biden's first press secretary became a regular fixture on TV screens and soon a household name. And after nearly a year and a half of fielding questions from the media, Jen Psaki made a move to the other side of the microphone, taking on a TV hosting gig at MSNBC. In her new book, Jen Psaki lays out her approach to communication and shares stories from her time in politics and media. It is called Say More, Lessons from Work, the White House, and the World. Jen Psaki, hello.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So we don't have government spokespeople here in Canada the way that you do in the United States. So let's just start off this way. I think for a lot of Canadians, when we imagine press secretaries, American ones, we imagine people like you and others who came before you. And then we also imagine this.
DJ.
Phil.
Did the president urge the chairman to hand over Abdul Mujib?
As I said, the president urged the parties to abide by the terms of the ceasefire, and he reiterated the United States' commitment to the peace process.
Katie. CJ, an AP report out of Gaza says the president threatened to withhold more than $100 million to Palestinian NGOs unless the chairman handed over Mujib.
Well, I'm not going to get into the details of the diplomatic exchange. There'll be more on that tomorrow. I'm told at this moment the House is getting ready to vote on the override of the president's veto, and I know you'll all want to cover that.
Well, that was actor Allison Janney playing fictional press secretary CJ Craig on the wonderful TV show The West Wing. So, Jen Psaki, that's what we kind of imagined the role being. And we know it's fictional, but is that portrayal at all accurate?
First of all, she's the best ever press secretary there was, CJ Craig. So let me just go on the record on that front. You know, it's funny for me personally, I had worked for Barack Obama, this is many years ago, on his presidential campaign. And then I was in the White House for a couple of years in a variety of roles. And I just left in 2011 because I was completely burned out. But then in the next 6 months, I'd never watched The West Wing before somehow. And I watched the entire series. And it's what prompted me to go back to government and rejoin the campaign in 2012. So it's very heartwarming for me to hear and listen to and obviously watch The West Wing. And now I get to work with Lawrence O'Donnell, who's one of the original writers. So it all comes full circle. But I do think I always tell people this. The West Wing is representative of the best of public service and what you want your day to be. Every day is not like a day on the West Wing, but that's the best days on the West Wing are what make people want to work as I have for years in Washington. Your listeners are probably familiar with other shows, including Veep, which is probably more reflective in some ways of the day-to-day absurdities that you experience on Capitol Hill and in lawmaking. But West Wing is aspirational. It is what public service is and should be. And I think it inspired so many people, myself included, at different times in our careers.
I love this so much. When we were talking about interviewing you, we said, like, let's just play our clip of The West Wing and see how it goes. I didn't realize how foundational that show was for you and the career choices. Yeah. I love it. So like CJ Craig and many others in the nonfictional world, part of the role of the press secretary is to be steady as she goes, not rise to the occasion. You had a reputation as being very unflappable when you were up there at the podium in the White House briefing room day in and day out. Is that who Jen Psaki is in real life?
No, not really. I mean, it's funny because in that role, especially when I served as White House press secretary, the country, the United States, was coming off of obviously an insurrection on our nation's capital, COVID. People were living through a trauma. 1,000 people were dying a day. It was a very traumatizing time period in the United States. And part of my role and what the president wanted me to do is, and some days I did this and some days I didn't meet this bar, was to try to take some venom out of the room and make the press room more of a place of stability and information than combat. Now, I disagreed with reporters at times, and we had our own exchanges and back and forths. But, you know, in that job, and I had been the State Department spokesperson for a couple of years prior, and that's different, but I learned a lot from that job. And what you always have to remember is, yes, you want to always be yourself, of course. And my family members would know if they were watching when I was absolutely pissed off because I would get a look on my face. But you're also representing the government. You're representing the president. You're representing the United States. And so you have to remember that and try to pull back moments where you might want to say, are you kidding me right now? Or other variety of responses.
Okay, so I want to pick up on a couple of things that you said in that answer there. The first one is you said, you know, some days, just like all of us, I wasn't like the best at my job. And you write about this in your book, like the good moments and the bad ones. But is there a standout moment from your time as press secretary when you feel for yourself you failed to get the message out, a failure of your own communication? Because your book is about how to be a better communicator.
Yes. And I talk in my book a lot about mistakes I made and what I learned from them. And I'm a believer that that is often when you learn the most. And a lot of stories in my, there are stories certainly in my book of moments of history I was ahead of front seat to. Those are amazing. But most of the times where I've learned a lot is when I wish I would have handled things differently. There are many. One of the ones I write about in my book, which is quite public, was during the height of COVID and the shortage of tests we had going on in the United States, also in other parts of the world, certainly. And I was experiencing this too as a person who was hoping to see my family and was trying to get enough tests so we could test every day around the holidays. The reporters in the room were experiencing this as members of the media, but also as human beings, which, by the way, they are too. And it was very tense during that period of time because we didn't have great policy answers on why we didn't have more tests. In a moment of weakness, in a moment of bad communication, I got a little flippant in my answer to a reporter who was actually asking a perfectly valid question. And I regret that. And it is a lesson, a number of lessons I drew from it. One is the White House briefing, for anyone who's been in the room as a reporter or as a staffer or just a visitor, it can be very repetitive. And as the spokesperson, you have to not say, you've asked this question 7 times, because of course that will be what is used in.
And you haven't answered it 7 times is what the reporter would probably argue back.
Well, they might, yeah. Or maybe you've given all you can, or maybe they are trying to do it for their broadcast, which is their right. And they want to ask it in a different way or ask it the same way so that they could edit it. That's what the briefing is for. But in the moment I got flippant and that doesn't translate, right? And it just was a reminder that you have to be patient and you have to be repetitive at times to get your message out. Because if you lose your cool, that's what people are going to pay attention to. And in that moment, there was a strong and visceral reaction to my flippant response. I had to kind of apologize the next day in some form or another. And that was a lesson for me in communicating.
Okay, to illustrate the point, I'm going to play a little bit of tape. This is of you at one of your White House briefings, and I'll explain it when we are done listening to it. Here we go.
Is it that the Biden administration is going to let the thousands of fossil fuel industry workers, whether it's pipeline workers or construction workers, who are either out of work or will soon be out of work because of a Biden EO, when it is and where it is that they can go for their green job?
Well, I'd certainly welcome you to present your data of all the thousands and thousands of people who won't be getting a green job. Maybe next time you're here, you can present that.
But you said that they...
So that's you, Jen Psaki, and an interaction that you had with Fox News reporter Peter Doocy. You went toe-to-toe with Doocy a lot in your time. I know you've said, like, look, off the stage, so to speak, we get along like fine. But he was a frequent sparring partners of yours at these briefings, as you both did your jobs. There's a lot of compilation reels of these exchanges online. They're really quite entertaining to watch, if I can put it that way. Jen Psaki destroys Fox host or reporter, shell-shocked after Psaki bomb, et cetera, et cetera. First of all, if you can tell our listeners what a Psaki bomb is. And I'm just wondering how you feel about that fandom, if I can call it that. And does it say anything to you about how people are consuming political content these days?
Well, on one hand, I'm quite flattered by it. And my sisters would occasionally wear Psaki bomb sweatshirts just to taunt me, as any good sibling does, right? Just to kind of make fun of me. I didn't coin the term. I think what it means is when I would just kind of shut someone down in the briefing room. And there were times that warranted that, because the previous administration had been attacked the press a lot, and also was not exactly full of facts at all moments. And so the briefing room had become kind of this place where there was a lot of shouting and venom spewed. And sometimes if somebody's giving a soliloquy speech and they're it's not a fact-filled speech, well, you don't like speeches in there anyway, you got to shut them down, because the truth is your audience is the public and it's your responsibility not to make it a forum for propaganda in there. So there were certainly moments like that with Peter Ducey. I did have fun with him at times because, you know, sometimes his questions would come packed with so many different things. And I would say to him, there's a lot packed in there. Let me just try to unpack it for you, because he would come often with, I can't imagine what it's like to work at Fox News, but he'd come often with sort of a slanted take on the news of the day. And sometimes he would come with valid criticism of something that was happening. It just really depended on the day. And it certainly wasn't only him. I mean, there were other people in the room who would come and spew kind of fact-free questions. And so I think it was about shutting it down, which, you know, you have respectfully, I mean, you can't do that job as the press secretary if you don't respect and value the role of media and the press and a free press. You wouldn't be able to do that job every day. And if you didn't enjoy the back and forth, oftentimes I would leave the briefing and have learned something. We need a better answer for this. We don't have enough information on that. I have to go ask somebody in the building a question to clarify this better. It sharpened your communications tactics, because it forcefully did. You had to be on your toes.
Yeah, there's that balance in any time you communicate, but especially in this political realm that we're talking about. You know, so you guys go at it, and nowadays it ends up on social media. And I'm wondering about the balance between sort of the performance and that butting heads with the civic function of these briefings. How do you see that balance?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And I'm glad you asked it, because I meant to add, you know, one of the things that is not a good reflection of how people consume information is I would have a back and forth with Peter Ducey, and the right wing would portray it as Peter Ducey crushes Jen Psaki, right? And the more left side of online Twitter would portray it as I did the same to him. And that is not a healthy way of people consuming information. I mean, you know, I can't single-handedly change the way people consume information, certainly not. But even those exchanges was a reflection of that. I will tell you, I didn't go out there with the goal of being performative. You are performing in the sense that you have to repeat things 10 times, right? You have limits of what you can say publicly. You're trying to project a message from the president and from the United States. But I didn't go out there with the objective of trending on Twitter. I mean, God forbid. I went out there with the objective of, here are the things we're trying to accomplish today. Here are the things that are trickier that I'm going to try to make some progress in clarifying, providing clarity on.
Jen, we know that trust in the media is low at this point in this point in our lives. Research shows that some of the main reasons relate to the perception of political bias. So it is no secret that MSNBC is popular with left-leaning viewers, and it's no secret that you are a Democrat. Were you concerned when you made this shift, right, that for the optics of joining this network, or how it would be perceived, or the actuality of it?
I wouldn't say I was concerned. Well, when I joined, I was concerned, like, will I have friends here? And will I learn how to read a teleprompter? Both have happened. The difference between, in my experience at MSNBC and some other outlets that I don't think have this bar, is we have a standards department. We're expected to share facts. I'm sharing opinion, but is it informed opinion? And people can self-select to watch my show or not. And I hope people do. But it is a reflection of my time working for many presidential campaigns and for two presidents and for the State Department. That means I can share perspective in a way that people who haven't had those experiences can't. But I do it in a fact-filled way. What I have found to be, and I thought this would be the case, but I have a tremendous amount of gratitude for, is no one's asked me to be anything other than who I am. It would be pretty inauthentic if I came in here and said, I am no longer a Democrat. I am neutral and I have no feelings about political parties, right? At the same time, what I've tried to do is I've had a lot of Republicans on my show. I've had people I disagree with on substance and policy because I think they're a part of the conversation and that's important. I also encourage debate and disagreement on my show because I think people can disagree and that can be a healthy thing. I do have certain bars. I don't have anyone who doesn't believe in the outcome of the 2020 election or who has supported in any way the insurrection on our country on my show, as do many other journalists who work at a range of outlets here. So that's how I've approached it. I think it was more about transitioning and knowing I had to prove myself that I could bring value to a show and to viewers. And, you know, you're judged by what you do in that sense and not what you say you're going to do. And now I'm a year and a half in, almost 2 years. I left 2 years ago, the White House. So I'm about a year and a half into being here.
Let's talk about Ronna McDaniel, because you and a number of your fellow anchors spoke out when NBC hired her, the former RNC chair, as a paid contributor. The network later reversed its decision. Conservative commentators, in sort of response, use your hiring Jen Psaki as an example as this double standard that they allege exists in the media. How do you respond to that?
I typically don't, because I know what the truth is. One, I never supported an insurrection. I can't believe I have to say that out loud. Two, I work here full time as an anchor. She was a contributor sharing her point of view. And three, I mean, I think that I bring a tremendous amount of value from my experience working for multiple presidential campaigns and for two presidents and holding myself to a high standard of credibility. So we are quite different. And I don't think that that comparison has really any grounds. And nor do I think it is something that is believed by the vast majority of my colleagues here.
Let's talk about it being an election year in your country. Your former boss, President Joe Biden, one of the least popular presidents in decades. I think a recent Gallup poll found his approval ratings to be about 38.7%. So you're a media person. You're a pundit, Jen. How do you explain at this point why President Biden is so unpopular in your country?
Well, here's what's interesting. I mean, a lot of his policies are popular. And we also, and that is a, it's better that than the alternative. So part of the challenge is communicating with the public about the choice in the election. People are dissatisfied, as you've seen in polls, of the choices they have right now. There is still a trauma this country and many parts of the world have been through. Obviously, COVID was a part of that and the economic recovery. The insurrection and the threats to our democracy has been a trauma to a number of many, many people in this country as well. And we ultimately live in a divided country. So I can't say I'm terribly surprised by what the approval ratings are. I know if you were sitting in the White House right now, you certainly want them to be higher. And part of how you do that is to communicate to the public, not just your accomplishments and where the data is going, like improving economic data and things like that, but who you're fighting for and who you want to fight for if you're given the chance of a second term. The challenge is that one, even a president cannot solve the divided nature of how people consume information, what they consume and what they believe. I mean, shocking, I shouldn't be shocked, number of Republicans in this country still believe Joe Biden didn't win the 2020 election. That's part of what you're trying to overcome. So there are a lot of factors at play. I think for him, what you're thinking about is, what do I do to convey to the American public that I'm a better choice than the other guy? That's ultimately what elections are about. Not who's perfect, but who's a better option.
Do you understand why Donald Trump is so popular? Like when you sit back and think about it and assess it from a communication standpoint and how he gets out there, do you get why he's popular amongst a lot of people?
I would say he's popular among his base, not popular writ large among the public, if you look at any poll. I think he's popular among his base because he has created effectively, and he's had a consistent message since he ran for president. He's created this perception that he is the victim, that he is under attack, that anyone who feels they are the victim can relate to him and he is like them. The irony is he doesn't care about other people who are the victims. He cares about himself, but that is effective. He also projects himself as someone who is from a place of strength, because he is attacks institutions, attacks people in government, attacks the media, attacks foreign leaders. And for people out there who are looking for someone, and there is a large swath of people clearly who support him, who are looking for someone who understands feeling aggrieved and who hates institutions, he has become a model for them. And it, what it tells you is that there is an audience for that in this country. And that's important for people to understand and recognize and not stick their head in the sand and ignore, because that is part of what is happening in the United States right now.
Let me ask you about some of the news things that are going on. Most recently, these campus protests, which are happening across your country and now in mine as well. This conflict is being seen as deepening the divide amongst Democrats, particularly with Arab Americans and younger people. How would you grade how the president is doing and the administration is doing in terms of messaging when it comes to this war?
Well, I think there's a lot packed in there. So let me just start with the protest.
that's the press briefing, Jen. Yeah, fair enough.
It's a complicated, important issue, obviously. You know, I think first, it's very difficult to communicate effectively and with through the political prism when it comes to diplomacy and global issues. I've learned this the hard way from working in administrations when there was, you know, when Assad was killing people with chemical weapons, when Egypt was, when there was a coup going on in Egypt that we didn't call a coup, you know, obviously the withdrawal from Afghanistan. It's very difficult to communicate effectively from the political prism about diplomatic issues, especially as they're ongoing. We're seeing that happen now. I mean, the best thing from a political messaging standpoint that can happen would be a ceasefire, right, between Israel and Hamas. That is obviously what the administration is working on. I think that on the protests, what's important to understand, and this may be the case in Canada as well, is that they're not monolithic. They're different on every campus, and the people who are protesting on each campus are coming often from a different place too. There is a population of students, some Palestinian Americans, who care deeply for good reason about the humanitarian suffering they're seeing in Gaza. That is a population. There are people who are going with their roommates who are just a part of it and don't necessarily know when they say, from when they're chanting from the river to the sea, that what they're saying when they're out there protesting a group of people who are being suppressed, that they are attacking another group of people who are suppressed, you know, which is Jewish Americans. There is anti-Semitism happening on campuses. There's also outsiders who are infiltrating some of these. So it's hard to talk about them in one thematic way. What is interesting, I think, is that some where some of these campuses, what I think is interesting in this current moment, and it's ever changing, hence the news, is some of these campuses where they've come to agreements with students, where the students have asked for something specific, like divestment from investment in Israel. That is very hard to implement as a university. And obviously there are donors that would be upset about that. But it is interesting when you see the students asking for something specific, peacefully protesting, coming to an agreement with the administration, and now the administration has to decide what to do. But I would also say what's interesting and surprising to me, frankly, is that there have also been a number of polls in the United States. One is the Harvard IOP poll, which is a very respected poll here, where it shows that the president, President Biden, has still needs to make up more ground with young people. He's leading Trump by about 13 points. He needs to win by more than that in order to win in November. But front and center in issues is not the war. It's actually the economy, housing, the cost of healthcare. Polls are imperfect. Sometimes they don't always capture things like abortion rights, which is unquestionably a huge issue here. But it's interesting because if you're on the campaign, you have to think about that and be mindful of it. So let me come back to your last question, which is an important one, but I just want to address the first parts. In terms of the administration's handling messaging wise, you know, I do think that what the president said was probably striking the right tone, reiterating the right to peacefully protest. That's who we are as a country. That's fundamental, but also kind of reflecting on what the lines that shouldn't be crossed are. Now, he's not the arbiter of that. That's up to universities and campuses and local communities. That's kind of how it works. But I do think it was important for him to address it. I also think it's important, and this could be controversial, that he's going to go speak at Morehouse University in a couple of weeks, where there will likely be protesters, and I'll have to deal with how he talks about it. You have to engage. That's obviously an important lesson of communicating. And I think these are some examples of him doing that. But ultimately, they're going to be judged not on his speech at Morehouse or his statement, but on sort of their ability to play a constructive role in resolving this, which the United States is not all powerful in, far from it, clearly, as is evidenced by the last several months.
I got to let you go. But before I do, you know, we live in very divided times. We talk a lot about that on my program, as you do as well. You've worked in, you know, two institutional areas that have great divisions and are under great scrutiny, politics and the media. And you wrote in your book that the transition out of the White House had its own set of challenges. There were existential challenges. Because you had to ask, when you're no longer speaking on behalf of someone else, you're faced with the question, what do I think? Here you are now in the media. You're not telling people what you think. You're doing a different kind of job. But how are you contending with that balance?
You know, I thought about this and I wrote about this specific example in my book a lot as it related to Joe Biden is still the president. I obviously worked closely for him for a year and a half. And I was going to be asked, and I still am, about what I think about different moments in his presidency. There are times when I've been critical. I'm sure they didn't love that. There are times where I have been kind of perspective offering, meaning like, this is, you're not seeing everything that's happening behind the scenes. There are times where I have been positive. The way I think about it is, how can I, and Jennifer Palmieri, who was a communications director for Obama before me, gave me this advice. The best thing you can, perspective you can provide people is, this is the kind of conversation that's happening in a White House right now. This is what you're thinking about. Most people have not sat at those tables. And it is curious for people. I'm not in those meetings anymore. I'm not talking to the president all the time. So I can't, I'm not going to speak like I am, nor would it be authentic to, but I can provide insight into what kind of things you're considering. So I try to do it from that prism, is how I often think about it.
It's been really good to hear your views on this and how you've sort of navigated both these roles. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure speaking with you.
Jen Psaki is a host on MSNBC, a former White House press secretary and author of the book Say More. You're listening to the Sunday Magazine on CBC Radio, Sirius XM 169, and on the CBC Listen app. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. And now, in somewhat of a demonstration of grit and resilience that some might call heroic and others might call stubborn, I am going to step into the ring for this month's round of That's Puzzling. Once a month, I take on one of my CBC colleagues and a super smart listener of the Sunday Magazine in his series of word challenges. It has been a while since Team Pia booked a win. By a while, I mean since last June. But like a true Canadian hockey fan, I believe this time it's going to be different. And if it isn't, I'm going to blame the ref. In this case, the ref is the man who comes up with our puzzles, Peter Brown. Boo! Also, hi, PB.
2 minutes for booing. Chattopadhyay. Pia, hello. It's nice to be back. But I, at this point in the season, honestly, I don't know what to feel. I want to hope that this is your week, but I'm almost afraid to hope, because hope can be cruel, can't it? But Pia, I am confident that you will give, is it 120%? What's the current athletic maximum percentage that you can give?
It's always just 100%. I really dislike when people say like more than 100%. It can only be 100%. That means you're giving it your all, which I always do. It just doesn't mean I come up with the W.
I like how outraged you were when I made the 120% joke, and I'm hoping you will harness that fury. Harness the fury, the Pia Chattopadhyay story. This week, players and listeners, I highly recommend you have a pen and paper handy. You will greatly benefit from writing down the clues. Let's meet Pia's opponents for this month. First of all, in our Toronto studio, from the CBC's Fifth Estate, it's Stephen D'Souza. Hello, Stephen.
Hello.
Stephen, I like to think of this as the Olympics or the World Cup of radio word puzzle challenges. But of course, those events are riddled with scandal and politics. Are you here doing an undercover investigation into corruption? And that's puzzling.
I can neither confirm nor deny any ongoing investigations at this point.
Stephen, are you a puzzle person? Do you do the Wordle connections?
I am, you know, and growing up, I played Boggle. I love Bananagrams and Scrabble. And even while courting my now wife, we played Scrabble against each other. And I think allowing her to win allowed our relationship to flourish.
That's wow. Intimidation right there.
That is the most romantic thing anyone has ever said about Scrabble. Stephen, thank you for joining us. It's great to have you. And our third competitor won their spot in today's game by entering our listener challenge. We asked you to invent a name for a phenomenon that was happening a month ago. Back in April, if you can remember, Canada's professional hockey, basketball, and baseball teams were all playing. We challenged you to invent a word for that sports eclipse. And our winning word is...
Trisportacular.
Trisportacular. Oh, how we miss the trisportacular. That is our winning listener, Joe Mather, in Sydenham, Ontario. Hello, Joe.
Hello.
Joe, are you a big baseball, basketball, hockey fan?
No.
Oh. What's your sport?
I watch tennis, and I get to watch a lot of English football because my husband is a Manchester United fan. So that's often on our house.
My condolences.
They're not doing well.
No. His Man United and my Liverpool are having sad times these days.
Joe,
of all the tennis immortals, Serena, Roger, Rafa, who will you be channeling today?
Probably Roger Federer.
Yes.
Oh, with grace and style.
He's always calm. He never gets upset. He won lots and he retired at just the right point. So
I will be a John McEnroe.
I was going to say the same. Yeah, I think I might be a McEnroe as well.
So I've got one symbol of grace and professionalism and two people yelling, "You can't be serious."
If that's all we're yelling, if we're channeling John McEnroe, that would be great.
True. Yeah. All right, I think we're ready. Stephen, Joe, Pia, let's play That's Puzzling. As always, we begin with a definition challenge. I'm going to give you a word and three possible definitions. One of those definitions is real, two I've made up. Your challenge is to spot the correct definition. Again, one real, two fake. Spot the real one for 1 point. Today's word is... apricate. A-P-R-I-C-A-T-E. Apricate. Which of the following is the real definition of apricate? Is it, in calligraphy, to add color to a letter or page? Is it to bask in sunshine? Or, when a bee apricates, is it doing that little waggly dance that shows the other bees where the pollen is? So, you're either adding color to a page, or basking in sunshine, or you're a little bee doing the wiggly dance. Which is the real one? Pia, I'm coming to you first, as always.
The bee dance, I'm thinking of Jerry Seinfeld as the bee in the bee movie.
Sure.
Dancing. And I'm laughing. I love that movie so much. Apricate. I don't know. Like, I could go with pollen and be silly and say, like, apricot, apricate. It's sweet. Pollen, bees, honey. But that's just a silly path. I'm not going to go down it. Apricate. What was the first one, the calligraphy one?
To add color to a letter or page. So some pages
are like a ply.
Quite colorful. They have, like, red letters, some of them. So that would be apricate, maybe.
I feel like you have stumped me lately, Peter, on some, like, technical definitions like that one. And then they've been kind of, like, just generic, like suntanning or whatever the second one is. So, okay, I'm not doing B, so now I'm stuck between these two. This is always about me not trying to figure out the definition, but trying to figure out how Peter Brown's brain works. I have failed miserably. I'm going to go where my brain says it should, which is nowhere. I'm going to total guess. Bask in sunshine is what I'm going to just go with. Apricate.
Pia, having revealed her process, thinks it's to bask in sunshine. Stephen, what do you think?
Well, I am also going to try to get into your head, Peter, and I think when I see the first one, when I see calligraphy and I see apricate, I think applicate, and I think what you're trying to do is make us have an association with those two words. So I think you're trying to throw us a little curveball there. So I'm going to put a little X beside that first one. So now I'm left with the last two, Tabascan Sunshine and Dancing Bees.
Yep.
Seductively Dancing Bees, I guess you could say.
Your words, not mine.
Yeah. So here's where I go with this. I think of, when you think of bees, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, because I've covered a few of these stories.
What, bee stories?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. They're fascinating. Okay. They are farmed or kept in an apiary. And so the root of the word apiary, A-P or something, reminds me of apricate. So I am going to go, even though, and because it's so silly, again, getting into your head, I think you're trying to make it sound silly so that you'll throw us off. So therefore, I'm not going to take the bait. I'm going to say it's the bee dance.
I learned so much from the way the players think I think.
I'm also wondering, Peter, like, what is D'Souza secretly working on for the Fifth Estate about bees? Like, what is the big reveal? I guess we'll have to wait.
This is prior to my time at the Fifth Estate.
Okay, this is when you were a news reporter.
Back when I was a news reporter.
I thought it was like the burgeoning industry of bee discos or something. So, Joe, we have one player believes it's the basking in sunshine. One believes it's the wiggly bee dance. What do you think it is?
Well, I must admit I was leaning towards the basking in the sunshine. It sounded like something I could just go out and apricate. I'm looking outside of the window right now, and it looks nice and sunny, but it's only 10, so I wouldn't be basking too much. But, I think I'm going to stick with the bee, with the basking in the sunshine.
Right.
Sorry.
So, who is in my head? Is it no one? Is it Steven? Is it Pia and Joe? It's Pia and Joe.
Wow, we have cracked the code, Joe. Peter Brown's brain.
Even though today was not apricaceous. So I now, so you know, Pia, I'm now thinking, what does Pia think I'm thinking? So that's the level we're playing this.
Oh, boy.
This is a never-ending circular puzzle that we'll never, ever solve. Yeah.
So only 1 point on the board for Pia, one for Joe, none for Steven, but it's all to play for as we move into round two. Our second round today, ladies and gentlemen, we are playing a new game. This one is called The Missing Link. I'm going to give you three words. Those three words all have something in common, and we're looking for the common thing that connects the three words that I give you. In this first round, the three words that I give you will all connect to a fourth word. So I give you three, they all connect to word number four, and I'm looking for that fourth word that connects to the other three. So for instance, if I gave you dress, dial, and flower, and asked what word they all connect to, the answer is sun. Sundress, sundial, sunflower.
Oh, this is the worst of this.
Oh, you're
do we get a list of words to choose from, maybe?
Your misery fills me with joy. Now, guess what? It's a little more complicated than that. That already made you miserable. In that example, sun was at the front of all the answers. Sun dress, sun dial, sunflower. The connecting word might go after the clue word. So if I gave if I gave you eight, the number eight, and skate and stick, eight, skate, and stick, the answer would be figure. Figure eight, figure skate, and stick figure. There is a hint available every time, and these are worth 2 points. Again, I'm going to give you three words. You tell me what fourth word connects all of them. Do we think we understand what's happening here?
Yes.
Let's not answer that, because if we do badly, we can just say we didn't understand it.
All right. Joe, the good news is you're up first.
Uh-oh.
And there's a hint available. Your words are golf, shopping, and wheel. Golf, the sport, shopping, and wheel. Wheel.
Oh.
Cart.
That is absolutely right.
Yes.
Well,
Joe, for 2 points. Cart is the right answer. Golf cart, shopping cart, and cartwheel. See, this is going great. Pia.
Got Joe's. Now here's the trouble.
Yeah.
Here comes trouble. trouble.
Pia Chattopadhyay, you are up. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is terribly hard.
Oh, don't do that to me. That's so mean.
Pia, this is punishing, and you're brave to even try. Your words are dish, opera, and hand.
Okay, dish, soap, nope. Dish, opera, and hand. Opera house, house hand. Dish ho- okay. Opera, opera. Oh, shoot.
Oh, you're so close, Pia.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So, it's a, so wait, what did I say? Opera house? Opera.
Oh, start again at dish.
I feel like La Traviata. Okay, start again at dish soap. Opera glasses, dish glasses, glasses, dish, hand glasses. Oh,
I'm
going to
pause you, Pia.
Everyone hear all the sighs.
Pia, I'm going to pause you. Can you think of a way of connecting soap to the other two words?
Soap dish. Oh, a soap opera. Hand soap.
Yes.
Soap.
So the answer we were looking for there was soap, as in soap dish, soap opera, and hand soap. Yet, Pia, I have never heard you say the right word in 5 seconds and then spend 30 seconds walking away from it. That was tremendous. Confidence, Pia. Stephen, your words are measure, worm, and video. And so far, hints haven't been needed, but one is available. Measure,
measure worm,
and video.
Wait, worm or word?
Worm as in worm. The invertebrate. Worm, yeah.
Measure, measuring? No, measure. Measure video, worm, yes, of course. Measure, tape measure, tapeworm.
Tapeworm.
And then videotape.
Yes, Stephen.
Ha ha.
Yes. I love that the TV guy said videotape with a question mark sound after. Videotape? What is that?
Remember when we used to use that once upon a time?
Stephen was right. The correct answer, tape, tape measure, tapeworm, and videotape. So after all the moaning and groaning, you all nailed the first round without a hint. How do we feel about ourselves now?
I feel like there's a train coming down the tunnel that's about to run us over.
I'll just admit, yes. I wouldn't have gotten that last one. I wouldn't have gotten it. I when Stephen said them, I was like, obvious when someone gives you the right answer, I wouldn't have done it.
Yeah, I thought of measure tape, but I thought it's a measuring tape, so I wasn't sure.
That's what threw me off at first.
But that's why it's tape measure.
Exactly. Mm. So the bottom line is,
of course,
Stephen has two, Pia has three, and Joe has three. This is anyone's game as we move into round three. Now we turn into our final round. Good news, it's a different version of the missing link. You've mastered that other one. In this round, we're not looking for that connecting word. I'm going to give you three words in the same category. So if I said butter, cheese, and yogurt, what category are they all in?
Dairy.
Milk products. We're looking for the group the words belong to. These are worth 2 points. Hints are available. What we do is we go 3-2-1 here. So, Stephen, you in third place, go first.
Woo-hoo.
Your three words, and remember there's a hint, are fudge, cook, and fiddle. What are all those words examples of?
Wait.
Okay, say them once more.
Fudge, cook, and fiddle.
Yeah. Oh.
Cook.
Yeah, I heard fudge and cook, and I thought, okay, this has to do with baking, dessert, cooking, and then fiddle. Where are you coming with fiddle? Okay. give me a second here. Fudge, cook, fiddle. Oh, wait a minute. See, my first thought was to go towards food. And see, again, I'm getting in your brain, Peter, because I know what you're trying to do here. What's the word? Like, I think like cooking the books or fudging or making a mistake, fiddling with numbers.
That is correct.
Yeah.
Fudge, cook, and fiddle, all different ways of saying you're manipulating numbers in a dishonest fashion. Cook the books, fudge the numbers, and fiddle with the books or fiddle with the numbers. Pia, your three words are roll, R-O-L-L, wrap, W-R-A-P, and cut. Roll, wrap, and cut. And again, not cooking related. Roll, wrap,
okay, because I was going to go like sandwich, but it's not. These have to do with like a movie things, like director's cues.
Nailed it.
Whoa.
Yes, Pia. Roll, wrap, and cut are all things a director would say on a movie set.
Yeah, that was easy.
Too easy? Do you want another one?
No, gosh, no. That was so hard. Oh, my God. I'm a genius for solving that.
So right now, Pia has 5. Stephen has 4. Joe has 3. If Joe gets this, we are in a tiebreaker. If Joe misses, Stephen gets a chance to win. And I will say this. I'm very proud of this clue. This may be the hardest one.
Oh.
Your three words, write them down. Your three words are define, stupendous, and hijack. Define, stupendous, and hijack. And the connection has nothing to do with what those words mean.
Oh, Joe, I'm sorry. You're a guest on our program. Why are we doing this to her?
The hint is, look at the start of the words.
S-H. This time? Oh.
Look at what happens at the start of each word. Define, stupendous, hijack.
I am looking and I still can't
Me too, Joe. Me too. De-stu-hi.
De-stu-hi. Hi, Destu. Okay. Does the order of the words you gave make a difference?
It makes no difference, Stephen. Okay. But right now, Destu, Joe is
too high. I'm stuck. I'm not getting that at all.
Oh boy, that's
no. Wow. I got both the first ones, but not this one.
Sorry, can you repeat the clue again?
Yeah, so the clue is define, stupendous, and hijack. The connection has nothing to do with the meaning. And you're looking a little narrowly at the start of the words, Joe.
D-S-H?
Hmm. Wow. Oh. I am...
No, I'm stuck. I'm sorry.
Wow.
Stephen, any idea?
I guess I could attempt to steal if I had any idea what this was.
Well, I'm glad you can't get it either.
Oh, gosh, no.
I feel so badly.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know even where to begin with the beginning.
No, I don't. The hint didn't help at all.
Deaf Stew Hidge?
Well, that's what I said too.
I think you're throwing all of us with that, Brown.
Can we have another clue?
At the start. What did you say? Look at the start of the words?
Yep.
That was the hint?
Wait a minute.
Yes,
the first three letters all follow each other in the alphabet.
That is correct.
Oh, D-E-F.
Yes.
Oh. Whoa. No.
Yes.
Stephen, what?
Stephen D'Souza.
Woo.
For the win. Define starts with D-E-F. Stupendous starts with S-T-U. And hijack starts with H-I-J. Stephen D'Souza, you, in the words of Queen, are the champion, my friend.
Oh, my God. Wow. Well done.
That was really good because I didn't get that at all.
He ain't stupid. Another word that starts with S T.
But I would never have gone without the clue.
We could have been here forever. I'd never have got it.
Like honestly, it would have taken me. No, I was gonna say hours. No, days. No, I don't know if I would. You could have locked me up and said the only way to get out is figure this out, and I'd still be locked up. Terribly
locked up with you.
As it seemed like none of you were getting it, I was going to say, spell the word slowly to yourself, and I was hoping D-E-F would trigger something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was a very hard clue, of which I was very proud.
Stephen, how did you, because you
I wrote them down.
This is
you know what happened is I underlined all three words, the first three letters of each word. And then as I looked at them, at first I just thought, oh, D-E follows D, and then T follows S. And then I realized, oh, actually the first three all do. So,
I would have never
have thought that one out either, too.
I like to play word games with my kids before bed, so I'm going to take this one home and test it out on them and see how they do, just to torture them before bedtime. Well.
Yeah, just really use it as a test of your, how much love they deserve. Stephen, congratulations.
Thank you.
Pia, once again, hair's breadth away from winning. Joe, like Roger Federer, maybe you haven't won as Djokovic. Maybe you haven't won as much, but you represent a level of class that is unparalleled in the game. How's that?
Thank you. I appreciate that.
What a delight to meet you, Stephen and Joe. Thank you for playing.
Thank you.
We had a great time having you on. And Pia, we will see you next time. And that is the May edition of That's Puzzling.
Thanks, everyone. We will be back next month with another round of That's Puzzling. It's going to be our final one of our season. Please let me win this season. If you want to play along with us, you can. Put your name in contention. We invite you to do so by taking on our challenge. We want you to invent a term for that feeling of biting into local produce for the first time of this season and remembering that, fruits and veggies do have flavor. So a made-up word. Email it to us, sunday@cbc.ca is our address. Put That's Puzzling in the subject line and please include your phone number. You have until the end of next Sunday, May the 12th, to submit the word you invent. A reminder, next Sunday is also Mother's Day. The winner will play on air next month and win a prize, a Sunday Magazine coffee mug or notebook.
And that's it for the Sunday Magazine for this week. Our producers are Levi Garber, Brianna Goss, Andrea Huang, Adam Killick, Samantha Louie, Pete Minton, and Ronde Williams. We had additional help this week from audio technician Juliana Romanek. Our senior producer is Howard Goldenthal. Our executive producer is Brian Colton. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you so very much for lending us your ear here on the Sunday Magazine.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.